You knew it was coming, guys. I want to hear your best Scooby-Doo impressions.
Raggy. That's my best Scooby-Doo impression.
That was pretty good, thank Eddie. You.
Shaggy.
Ooh. Oh, there we go. All right, I'm going to do one.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Laugh.
That was his laugh. And of course, Scooby-Doo.
Scooby-Doo.
Ruby, I love you, Raggy.
I think I could do a good Zoinks. Zoinks. No.
Zoinks? Is that him or is that Shaggy?
No, that's Shaggy.
It was Shaggy.
Oh, Zoinks? Shaggy. Zoinks?
Zoinks? Oh, man, Scoobs.
Yeah, it's like, that's like Scooby. Well, he has like, he has like a raspy voice.
My favorite was Jinkies.
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 Yeah. Jinkies.
That is, of course, Velma. So I guess that tells our audience what we're... what we're going to be talking about today. So you guessed it, Scooby-Dooby-Doo. And we're not going to go over its crazy long history because that would just be insane.
We're going to talk a little bit about it. I kind of it's weird because history is kind of important to understand the films we are focusing on. So we're doing the original Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? From 1969. Yes. Then we're going to jump to the live-action film from 2002.
I thought we were going to talk about Scooby-Zoo and Zombie Island a little bit.
We're going to talk about a bunch of stuff in between the first show and the first live action movie and now the very new animation movie, Scoob, which is available on Amazon Prime for $20.
It's actually available not just on Amazon Prime. It's available anywhere that has on demand.
Oh, okay. Yeah. On my computer came up, but that's because of Fire Stick.
Yeah. But it's available anywhere. So at iTunes, Roku. Not that we're promoting it. They're not paying us. I'm just saying.
Yeah,
let's get our facts straight here.
Yes, and we also, to get us through all of this Scooby-Doo mayhem, we have a very special guest.
It is Mike Jovic, and he is the host of a podcast named Scooby-Doo. And the podcast is great, guys. You guys should check it out because he interviews a lot of previous writers and producers of the show, voice actors as well, of all the different Scooby-Doos throughout history. So he is a good inside man, and we'll be talking and picking his brain about everything Scooby-Doo.
So without further Scooby-Ado, I'm Nicole.
And I'm Rolando.
And this is Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals.
An original podcast.
About unoriginality.
All right, guys, so we are here ready to talk to Mike Jozik, host of a podcast named Scooby-Doo. Mike, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for being here with us.
Very excited.
As I told everyone on our cold open, but I guess I'll repeat it again. Mike, you had this very cool podcast. It's running for about 4 years now. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Three.
3 years now. And you interview writers, voice actors, and producers from all the previous Scooby-Doo iterations that there have been.
That is correct. I am.
That is correct. Okay, good.
Basically trying to assemble an oral history of a franchise that hasn't gotten a lot of attention among animation aficionados. Because a lot of people look at Scooby-Doo as kind of garbage. They're like, why is this show going for 50 years? And my show got like half a season and got canceled because it's like low quality and stupid and whatever. But I mean, it's obviously got some staying power, so something's going on there.
Yes, 100% has staying power. I'm actually kind of curious because there's been so many revitalizations, to say the least, of the Scooby-Doo franchise. Do you have a personal favorite?
Yeah, pretty much the original 1969 series, Where Are You? Excuse me. It kind of... it sets the bar. It sets the template. I thought what the team was doing back then, they were kind of firing on all cylinders, despite being in that world of having to use limited animation. But it was a new thing, and it kind of had a slightly darker tone to it, which was kind of cool. And I love the background paintings, and it's great. After that, I would probably go with Be Cool. It is a show that incorporates a lot of comedy, but it's really smart, and it never betrays the the original sort of concept of, actually went back and watched a lot of those episodes because they wanted to sort of maintain, sorry, my throat. They wanted to maintain that sort of consistency of character and whatever, but they wanted to build on it and sort of give them some dimension.
Yes.
Plus weave in a whole bunch of crazy, like Marx Brothers style humor, Monty Python style humor.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, Be Cool, Scooby-Doo, for those who might not know, is one of the very latest reincarnations of the Scooby-Doo franchise that was on Cartoon Network and is on Boomerang currently. Debuted in 2015, and it's got a fresh millennial spin on it, in my opinion. And it's just...
Sorry, I was just going to say, season one ran sort of intermittently on Cartoon Network, and then season two came out something like 18 months later, and ran exclusively on Boomerang. It was a weird, troubled production, but...
Oh, yeah, I wish there was more. There were only two seasons. I wish there was more, for
stories
sure.
Stories behind that.
Oh, fun. So, on a scale of 1 to 10 also, everyone, you know, 10 being diehard fan, 1 being don't care, how much do we like Scooby-Doo in terms of fandom? I'm going to say right now I'm like kind of like an 8. Before this, I was like a 3.
But
I can confidently say that during everything that I've done in the past week and a half, I am an 8 on the Scooby-Doo fandom spectrum. So what about you guys?
I would say for me consistently, I have been a 7, 6 to 7.
6 to 7?
Maybe 6.5. And that stayed since before we were going to cover the podcast and after rewatching some of these properties and kind of making my own new opinion off of these. I'm like a 6.5. to 7.
Okay. Producer Eddie, what about you?
I feel like maybe 8.5 to 9.
8.5 to 9, big.
Yeah, because rewatching this stuff, I kind of realize, oh my God, a lot of like who I wanted to be when I grew up was kind of shaped by these shows,
you
know, especially Scooby-Doo. Like I always had this kind of fantasy of growing up being like a private eye or a detective and solving crime or figuring out like my fascination with supernatural mystery. You know, I can like stem back being a little kid and just watching these shows and even the clone versions of this show too. Like I've seen practically all of them. But I'm a big fan of this franchise.
And Mike?
I'm probably gonna surprise you. I would normally have said probably a 7. Because growing up it's just always been around and it was one of my favorite Saturday morning cartoons. I remember when you guys first asked me to be on the show, and you were like, I guess you're a huge Scooby-Doo fan. And I was like, eh, not so much. I could see the look of concern in your eyes when I said that. But since doing
confusion, I think.
Since doing the podcast, I'd probably say 8, 8.5, just because I do have a wider appreciation for sort of the productions themselves and how each are kind of unique. And I've sort of just, soaked up the characters a little more. But I'm not one of those fans who, like, knows all the episodes and, you know, knows
the original air
costume changes. And, it's like, I don't have that encyclopedic knowledge. But there is definitely an appreciation and love for it at, like, an 8, 8.5.
Awesome. So we're kind of fairly all around the same.
I'm going to be... I'll be fairly honest. Like, I think I can see myself like end up liking Scooby-Doo after hearing you guys talk about it some, just because, I mean, right now I guess I still have my own like preconceived notions of Scooby-Doo from, you know, what I knew as a little kid and watching these new properties and stuff. I'm still like kind of stuck in that. It's hard to break that mentality. Even watching like the two movies, you know, I'm still kind of stuck there. So let's see. Maybe you guys can like flip me, and maybe I'll go into like the 7.5 to 8.
Not much of a jump, but
Scooby-Doo intervention here.
Yeah, Scooby-Doo intervention. I love it. Well, so then we should just get right into it. And again, we're doing the first show, Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? From 1969, and then we're gonna jump to the live-action movie, and then of course finally the new Scoob. But I'm gonna give a little history, and of course, you know, Mike in particular, jump in if you'd like to. But let's go back to the early 60s, and let's talk about a show called The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis. Do we know this show, guys?
We do.
Awesome. Eddie and Rolando?
I do not, but well, I don't.
Oh, I just recently discovered this.
Did
yes.
you? Awesome. Okay, so The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, it was a show that aired around CBS for about four seasons from 1959 to 1963, and it was about a young boy named Dobie Gillis, kind of like his life, and it was very much a show that was depicting teenage life at that time, and it was about Dobie Gillis and a couple, his family, of course, and his friends. Some of his friends being Maynard, who is played by Bob Denver, who is kind of like a goofy, kind of beatnik, almost borderline pre-hippie era, you know, kind of like in a weird way, raggedy. There was mm-hmm. Zelda. There was Thalia. Zelda was kind of like the smartest girl in high school and then in college. And Thalia was like a beautiful classmate. And then, yeah, there was Dobie himself, who was blonde and clean cut, and he was just a born leader. This sound kind of, it doesn't sound familiar, right? Not at all. Well, so let's go to these two men called Joe Ruby and Ken Spears, who really thought there would be a great idea for teenagers in a haunted house. He was like, I think this is going to be a hit. And he came up with this concept about four teenagers who, well, the two of them, mixed, developed by other animators, about four kids and a dog, not important right now, kind of like bumbling around, bumbling around a haunted house. And it was called Who's Scared? I think it was something like that. You have something to jump in with, Mike?
Joe Ruby and Ken Spears, they worked for Hanna-Barbera at the time. They were writers there. And the shows at that time were very much either the network would come to them and want something, or Joe Barbera would have to go to the network and sell the show. And as far as the story kind of goes, Fred Silverman was wanting to put something new on the TV, on the network, and went to Hanna-Barbera, and they wanted kind of a mystery because it hadn't combined like comedy and mystery before, and they were, I think, sort of following the example of like Johnny Quest having like a full half hour kind of adventure show, because before then you look at like Yogi Bear and Huckleberry Hound and kind of what Hanna-Barbera was known for, and they were shows that were half hour blocks that were split into like two or three installments or cartoons, like different characters. And so between Silverman kind of working with Hanna-Barbera and Joe Barbera was on the development side, you know, he would have tasked Joe Ruby and Ken Spears to sort of write up a concept based on what Silverman and Barbera kind of worked out. And then Iwo Takamoto, who was the character designer at the time of the studio, like Joe Ruby and Ken Spears told them sort of the basics of the characters. And then Iwo would kind of draw them out based on those descriptions. And so it would just kind of keep going around the circle of creatives. And as you said, they came upon the idea of Who's Scared. To an extent, they were like basing it on, I mean, most Hanna-Barbera shows were based on something. Huckleberry Hound was Andy Griffith, Bobcat with Sergeant Bilko. So they were kind of following the example of like the Archies. They wanted them to travel around. They were a band that traveled around in their van. Their dog was named Too Much.
Too Much.
And
yeah, and the show got rejected initially too, right?
Yeah, the original pitch for Who's Scared was deemed too scary. They had to kind of like tone it down. And there's some interesting conflicting stories, which is kind of the whole reason why I sort of do the podcast, because with something this old and with people like Joe Barbera involved, I mean, there's a certain amount of mythologizing that sort of goes behind
for sure
the creation of these things. And as I've as I've read Iwo's biography, and I'm reading Bill Hanna's biography right now, and listen to interviews with Ruby and Spears, and you hear some people came up with things that other people say they came up with. And you know, Fred Silverman famously came up with the name of Scooby-Doo because he was on the plane heading to the pitch meeting or whatever, and he heard Frank Sinatra, Strangers in the Night, Scooby-Doo. But Iwo Takamoto in his biography says that he won't dispute that. It was long enough ago that he can't say with 100% certainty, but he can say with 100% certainty that because Hanna-Barbera was well known for having dog characters, either as primary, you know, stars of the show or secondary characters like Bandit and Johnny Quest, there were just always preliminary designs of dogs. And yeah, he said there was a dog sketch, not a Great Dane, but it was a dog, and it had the name Scooby written under it. So it is a name or an idea that could have been floating around the studio, and it could have been something that was picked up and pitched. And I've never been able to, I haven't gotten to talk to Joe Ruby and Ken Spears yet. They're the only like surviving members from that original group. Uh-huh. But that's something that I really want to get to the bottom of, because I've heard Joe Barbera come up with, you know, yeah, I came up with Scooby, and Fred Silverman says he came up with Scooby, and then Iwo says that's yeah, just kind of floating around. So it's this
ambiguity,
mishmash of a lot of different things.
Yeah, yeah. Which is also kind of what appropriately Scooby-Doo is. But yeah, so Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? Initially premiered as a Saturday morning cartoon for CBS, and it ran mm-hmm. for two seasons from 1969 to 1970. So there are five main characters. There are Fred Jones, Daphne Blake. I never remember their like last names for some reason, so I always have to have it in front of me. Velma Dinkley, Shaggy Rogers, and Scooby-Doo.
Velma Dinkley is, I think, the most. That's the one I always remember.
No, well, again, so I'm kind of new to Scooby-Doo. So.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
And, of course, Scooby-Doo. Casey Kasem, who we talked about before in this podcast, and we falsely said he was dead before. Or he was alive, but he's dead.
We claimed he was alive.
I had to correct you guys.
He did the voice originally of Shaggy, and Don Messick did the voice of Scooby-Doo. And Don Messick did this voice beautifully up until his death in 1997, even though the Scooby-Doo property for a period of years in the 90s was kind of dead. But yeah, so the two seasons, all of them which are available on Boomerang, I watched a few and I loved it because it's a murder mystery of these five kids just going around solving it, and it follows the laws of the natural world, which is also something I loved about this, where everything can mm-hmm. be explained.
Right.
There is no witches. There is no Dracula. There is no weird shining knight that just comes alive at a museum. That's all, you know, yes, a real estate agent or the, you know, really angry gas station owner. And just there's always right, someone behind a mask who gets foiled by these
kids.
There's
no murder usually. Mm-hmm. Usually it's greed that drives these people. But I don't think it ever got so dark to be murdered.
Yes. About the Carl Sagan thing, right?
Carl Sagan appreciated the original run of Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? Because of the fact that it taught kids about skepticism, you know, to question what you see. Uh-oh. And to a lesser extent, the fact that everything can be explained. So that was very much this mm-hmm. show's MO. It didn't greatly differ within those two seasons, but there weren't a lot of episodes. I think there was only 41. So, yeah. And yeah. So what do you guys watched it. Thoughts on this show?
It's interesting, right? So for me, where Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? Like, I think when I used to watch it, I actually used to watch it. I thought it was, the sequel to A Pup Named Scooby-Doo, because that's the one I saw
yeah,
first.
Yeah.
Right? I thought that was, oh, we're following them as adults now. And I actually, even when I was rewatching this, I thought that Scooby-Doo was, an hour-long show. But then I come to learn that it's just, oh, no, the originals were half hours, and they go on to be an
yes,
hour.
Yes, later on, yeah.
And those mysteries are a little more elaborate. And but I think Cartoon Network just used to play all these Scooby-Doos, together, as if they were just a Scooby-Doo, just Scooby-Doo. So I have no idea, what was Scooby-Doo, Where Are You... The new Scooby-Doo adventures, Scooby-Doo and Scrappy-Doo. Because I remember at one point or another, Scrappy-Doo also got thrown into the mix. Yeah. There were all these constant guest stars on Scooby-Doo that I remember, Don Knotts, Batman and
yes,
Robin, Josie and the Pussycats.
Saw that one.
You know? But no, even rewatching the show, I gotta say, the animation, it still holds up. In a really, really, wonderful, wonderful way. I know that they were trying to cut costs with, the repeating backgrounds and... even the limited detail for the faces and the clothing and stuff, but it does have its own very distinct style that if you look at all the iterations of Scooby-Doo, they haven't really deterred that much away from. They kind of became iconic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know?
No, I think the design of the show is just absolutely beautiful. You know, I love the way that the characters, they stand out compared to the backgrounds and to even like the people that they come into contact with. They kind of seem to be like, in a really, really cliche, cheesy way, a bright light in like a dark world and a dark and like masked world. And even though these characters, other than, say, Shaggy and Scooby, aren't very well developed, I think they actually have really important characteristic traits that I think are the iterations I kind of like best about them. For instance, Fred is very much the leader. You know, he might not be the one who solves the mysteries always, but he's always the one who's like, all right, this is what we're going to do. And he kind of helps lead them.
I always wonder, why is Fred... Like, why was Fred always the leader?
Because he's the white man.
He's like the handsome white guy?
I think it's because he owned the van.
He drove, so he got to tell people where to go.
You know what? That's fair. Like, when I used to drive my friends around, like, I'd call the shots.
There you go. He must be a Capricorn.
Fair enough. All right.
But just also quickly, Daphne, you know, even though she's very much a damsel in distress, and she always is, like, the one that they have to go and rescue, you know, she's just, like... She's kind of like the heart, to say it nicely. She's not very well expanded in this version, but she is very much the heart of the group. Velma is definitely the smarts, established from the very beginning, and Shaggy and Scooby are the adorable, you know, goofballs.
Kind of need Shaggy and Scooby there to leaven
Collins,
scary bits, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're always afraid, but they always, you know, like bite their courage sometimes, and they go for it, and it's always just adorable. So, I think the show is very charming. The laugh tracks, the music, the special effects that accommodate most of the Hanna and Barbera cartoons. I think Hanna and Barbera, this is, you know, prime pinnacle of their popularity. Wow, three Ps. But yeah, this is their era, and this is what they do, and this is what they do really, really well. So I really enjoyed it.
I mean, it's a cute show. Was this your first time, like, watching Scooby-Doo?
Yeah, so Scooby-Doo was a cartoon that would come on Cartoon Network, and I would turn it off.
Interesting.
I knew about it, though, because when you're kind of surrounded by something, you don't need to watch it to know, like, how it works. So I knew the formula, and I knew the characters, but I never really gave it a shot, which is surprising because I love murder mysteries.
That's what I was going to say. It's just like, I mean, aren't Murder, She Wrote formulaic?
Okay, listen. Murder, She Wrote is the greatest show ever. I don't need you talking
I'm
about it.
I'm not denying
like
this. But it does follow a formula.
Kind of. But that's also what's so beautiful about it is you take comfort in the fact that J.B. Fletcher will always solve it. You take comfort in the fact that the mystery gang will solve it at the end and that it isn't a ghost. It isn't a witch. It isn't Dracula, you know, which is something that changes. But in this version, I think works really well and didn't need to be changed or questioned, at least for a while.
Okay. Mike, your thoughts?
I love the show. I've loved it since I was a kid. There's some bizarre device in my brain that has adapted so that, I mean, you say it's formulaic, and yes, it is formulaic. Literally, they have so few extra characters that pretty much the first person you meet is the villain. My brain will not accept that until it's actually revealed.
That makes sense. I get it.
Yes.
And I forget it every time so that as I'm watching, I'm like, who is Captain Cutler? Who is, you know, the whatever phantom? It's almost like...
The witch, the zombie.
Yeah.
Almost like my brain wants to protect me or protect my enjoyment of the show and not just like... have me know everything about it. I don't know, it's weird, but yeah, like I said at the opening, there's so much kind of technically going right with this show. I mean, people don't give enough credit. Nicole mentioned how the characters stand out from the backgrounds. Like, those characters have to be designed in such a way to work well together, to not contradict each other, either in physical, you know, stature or shape or color design. Plus, they had to stand out from the backgrounds. I mean, a lot of work goes into that, and I think they did such a great job.
They did.
If you just look at those things isolated, like, they're beautiful, beautiful paintings.
Yes,
I don't have any of those things sitting on my wall.
Yes.
And despite the fact that they were really churning these things out and they wrote a whole bunch of them and they struggled to find, you know, how do we do this the same but different? They still manage, like, as repetitive as it is, you kind of invest in the friendship of the group of characters.
Yes.
And you just like seeing them operating and doing their thing. And I love how, again, Nicole mentioned sort of like their archetypal roles, but that wasn't really explicitly said at the time. Like, nobody says, hey, Fred, you're the leader. What are we going to do?
Yeah.
And I never feel like any character sort of has more power over another. The whole danger-prone Daphne thing, I think, is something that sort of worked its way in later. I don't think she's quite the damsel in distress a lot of people say she is. And there's no real gender roles. You know, it doesn't matter if you're male or female or canine, or however you want to define.
Yeah.
I'm always uncomfortable talking gender these days. Some people don't even recognize gender at all. But there are no traditional roles where, like, you watch the Flintstones or the Jetsons and they're very, you know, domestic. These are teenagers. There's no romantic. The romantic stuff came in much later. They're just four really good friends and the dog. And they're solving mysteries. And they're all equal. And I really, really dig that about that show. And I think that's really interesting and progressive and doesn't get enough credit.
Well, I was going to say, in terms of, like, the gender roles, like, it's true for the most part. Like, I mean, the few episodes I saw, or rewatched at least, Daphne was, I think, only the damsel in distress, like two out of the five times that I saw, maybe three. Like, you know, she got caught by the monster stuff. But outside of that, like, for the most part, like, you know, Velma is smart, and there is actual. I mean, I always read, I guess, just it was just like, maybe, you know, how you watch pop culture and it just gets ingrained in you. But I always read, like, Freddy and Daphne as a couple. But then, you know, rewatching this, just like, there's no sign. I made that up in my head.
Yeah.
And, like, the later iterations are the ones that kind of go with that. But there was no sexual chemistry between. They were just, like, all platonic friends.
Yes. Another reason why I love the show. I also love how 60s it is. You know, it's 1969, and you really get that energy of the era, and that not just with, like, the grooviness and whatnot, but, like, the idea of kind of, like, the kids being the one to kind of kids versus the older generation, which was a big thing in the 60s, and, like, the mistrust or the difference between now and, like, love versus kind of the older generations. I'm kind of making it more that way, but you could read that very much into it. And I also want to say that my favorite thing about this is that they established the way Velma runs, which is weird, which are, like, her like hands are here. And every time Velma runs, she's just like this. And it's my favorite. Other than the fact that she loses her glasses, she runs like a dinosaur. So that's definitely one of my favorite things about this. But yeah, I'm really charmed by this show. And there hasn't been that long of a period of time where we didn't get a different show of Scooby-Doo, whether it's Scooby-Doo or RU or another named show. And for a while, the show didn't really change too much in format, which is also really nice. They were like, you know, it works, so why change it? I feel like once it got to be an ABC property, it kind of became a little bit more experimental. But let's kind of talk about some of the in-between shows between our next big property we'll talk about, which is the live-action film.
Sure.
So right after Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? For two seasons, CBS did another reincarnation of it, the new Scooby-Doo movies, which were hour-longs. And that's where they had the Batman and Robin episode you're talking about. That's also where they met Don Knotts, you know. They're like, let's expand Scooby to, like, play with groovy people, man. And I love it. It was really, really fun.
And you know what's even more interesting? Like, Batman and Robin, that was the show before even they had Justice League, right? So that predates it. And then they got the spinoff, which is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Scooby-Doo and the Scooby Gang and the Mystery Guys and Batman make a great team. I really enjoy that. Yeah. I'm not the biggest Batman fan, but I really actually enjoyed those episodes because they met up with them a few times.
There were a few times. Yeah.
So after that is the Scooby-Doo show, which was a segment of the Scooby-Doo / Dino-Mutt Hour, which was a character, Dino-Mutt of Blue Falcon. We will be seeing again, so I'm going to mention that. And Scooby-Doo show of Scooby's All-Star Laugh Olympics.
Right.
Yep. And then there was the Scooby-Doo and Scrappy show. This is around the time that Scooby-Doo is ABC, and they think that the Scooby-Doo is kind of like losing its appeal, so they wanted to make it more appealing to a younger audience and just to get their fan base back, and they wanted something new and something fresh, so they made Danny DeVito as a puppy, and
Joe
they made
Pesci,
Scrappy-Doo,
not Danny DeVito,
or Joe Pesci, I should say, which is, I would say Joe Pesci. But he was a big hit at first, you know, he did save the show.
Oh, yeah. The show was literally on the chopping block. Like, ABC was willing to go another direction. They were like, back then, I mean, franchises just really weren't a thing. And it was, do we want to go someplace new, or do we want to do this old thing? Are kids still watching this? Like, it was, the Saturday morning programming was a lot more kind of willy-nilly.
Very, very wild.
Yeah, it was not like a foregone conclusion that we're just going to continue with this until the ratings go down kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think ratings had actually kind of gone down somewhat, and there was the repetition of the concept. So bringing in Scrappy was something new. And everybody that I've talked to who's worked during that period of the series, like, there were detractors at the time, but for the most part, ratings went up. The character was popular, and the people working on the show, for the most part, kind of enjoyed having that new element to work with the other characters. Where things, of course, went awry was when they got rid of your sort of straight non-humor based kind of characters like Fred, Daphne, and because there's a balance, right? It's like a pH balance of water.
Actually, show of hands, did anyone here like Scrappy? Because I like Scrappy.
I dig Scrappy.
I did like Scrappy.
I like Scrappy. Yeah, okay. My girlfriend's a big Scrappy Doo fan, so
I mean, he was cute.
If he's written right.
Yes.
Right. For sure.
He's just so different from the rest of them, too, that he brings in this new element that you're like, okay, I didn't think I needed this, but I'm enjoying it. And I really feel like Scrappy Doo hate-dom happened when the internet happened. Like, people just found, like, a common place in it, and then it just kind of, like, became common knowledge, which is something that happens in the film.
It's cool to hate things, right? You jump on that bandwagon.
I also think it's just like, because Scrappy kind of falls under, you know how people say, like, jump to shark?
Yes.
But people forget that, like, Happy Days lasted several seasons after that moment, right? Like, we remember it a certain way, but, like, the history tells us otherwise. Yes. Same thing with Scrappy Doo. Like, people are misremembering things because they think he's, like, a shitty character. However, they're kind of thinking about what's that family? You know, the Brady Bunch. They're thinking of Brady Bunch and that cousin
Oliver.
Yes, cousin, that's exactly. Oliver. You know, bringing in a new younger
cousin
character,
Oliver.
And the whole show derails. Yeah. But that didn't happen here with Scooby Doo. We remember it that way, but that's not how it happened at all. Because I remember liking Scrappy Doo. I don't know where the Scrappy Doo hate came from.
Yeah,
you're probably right. It probably was the internet.
I think just people who felt that way, you know, shared a common interest, and then it expanded from there. But so Scrappy Doo was around for a while. There was even the new Scooby Doo and Scrappy Doo show, and then the new Scooby Doo Mysteries. There's like 16 of these shows. But there's one that came out in 1985 called The 13 Ghosts of Scooby Doo that is really interesting, and I kind of wanted to talk about a little bit because this is where things begin to change. The show, for the most part, kind of dabbled in its belief system, which is that things could be explained, and that everything happens within the logical world of the natural law of you know, the world. But with the 13 Ghosts of Scooby-Doo, we left that world, and the unexplained kind of took over. The supernatural.
With Vincent Van Gogh.
With Vincent Van Gogh and Flim Flam.
Played by Vincent Price.
Yes, by Vincent Price and Flim Flam, who is way worse than Scrappy-Doo. He just kind of, like, complains the whole time. And I don't know why, like, I know a lot of people have generally kind of forgotten about that character, but I'm like, why is there no hate to this guy? But There is? Okay, I didn't get enough. I feel like Scrappy-Doo is pretty famous, so I need to get a little deeper in the fandom to hear the
Yeah, most people know more about Scrappy because he lasted longer.
Yeah. Yeah, Flim Flam was just in 13 Ghosts, but there's a shift within the franchise, and the supernatural and the unexplained begins to happen. Not very well done, because I didn't think 13 Ghosts was very good, but it was very interesting.
Oh, really? All right, so I'm in the outlier here. I did not rewatch it, though, but I remember as a kid, I did like 13 Ghosts of Scooby-Doo.
Wow. As a kid, yeah.
I dug it.
You should rewatch it.
It could have been Vincent Price. It really could have been. But I did like the idea of like Scooby-Doo fighting these real monsters that they accidentally unleashed. Mm-hmm. It was Shaggy, Daphne,
yes.
and
with,
Scooby
with the,
that
the
unleashed
box.
These monsters.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I think like a lot of Scooby-Doo properties, 13 Ghosts was a great idea, mm-hmm. but the execution, I feel, was lacking.
Yes, particularly with the animation. It kind of felt like it wasn't very, it was rushed, you know, wasn't fine-tuned. And some of the characters went missing in some of these versions that these revitalizations too, which is not the greatest thing. But Daphne's back for 13 Ghosts of Scooby-Doo.
As was Scrappy.
Yes. Then came a pup named Scooby-Doo.
Which was my introduction to the Scooby-Doo world.
Yes. And I think which is important, actually, for the live-action film, because there's some character traits that get established here. Daphne's rich, and she's kind of like a spoiled little girl in this show, to say mm-hmm. the least. Fred is not very bright. Right. And Velma is definitely the kind of spoken, intellectual, and rational leader of the group. So those characters
she's a rational
get
one.
Explained. Well, yeah, she's also very smart.
She's the one who,
I mean,
yeah, she's the one who she has a computer.
Yeah.
She has all the gizmos and gadgets to kind of do research and stuff. Yeah.
And this is when they're kids. So it's kind of like the Scooby-Doo gang has always been together, kind of like Muppet Babies, where they all just kind of grow up together.
Theme
that was very popular with these characters, a bunch of characters we've been familiar with for a long time.
An interesting thing that I ran across was that Iwo Takamoto, besides the very first series, his favorite series was a pup named Scooby-Doo. He thought it was the one that adhered the closest to kind of like the original idea and had the sort of love put into it and the designs he really enjoyed, which I thought was kind of interesting because it's also a show that imprinted so indelibly on a generation.
Yes.
Like I run into so many people who just love the music. They love the characters. Like that show is just everything to them.
Yeah, that's my girlfriend too. Yeah.
It is a solid theme song. Scooby-Dooby, Jinkies. Come on. It's such a good song. It really is. I prefer, when I think of Scooby-Doo, I think of that song first before I think of the Scooby-Dooby-Doo, Where Are You? And that's because this is the show I saw first as a kid.
And Tom Ruger, who ran the show, who developed the show, he actually asked Bill Hanna to direct the pilot episode, which Bill Hanna was like, I'm too busy. And he's like, please, please, please. And he just kept haranguing him until Bill was like, I'll give you a week. And he spent a week working on the show. So I think it might be the last thing, last animated property that was directed by Bill Hanna.
Interesting. What was the first episode for A Pup Named Scooby-Doo? Do you know? Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm actually working on the writer of that episode to do an audio commentary.
Ooh.
So hopefully.
Ooh, stay tuned.
I will say though, in terms of theme songs, I really love the Scooby-Doo show one. I can't remember how it goes right now, but Shaggy's part of it, and he goes, "Come on, every Scooby-Doo," it like goes something like that. I don't know. Every time I watch that show, kind of. Yeah, there was like, and they had more horns in that one. And I just love that Shaggy's in it. Come on, every Scooby-Doo. Anyway. But yeah, so there wasn't a television show for almost 10 years. And I think it's within that time frame that Zombie Island came out before we got a new TV show of Scooby-Doo.
Ma'am, do not disrespect Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island like that. It's Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island.
Okay.
All right. And it is easily, like, this is another one. So, like I said, as a kid, I watched A Pup Named Scooby-Doo. That's what got me into Scooby-Doo. And then I stumbled into Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? And I saw, it's like, oh, good. They made, like, a show of them as adults. I'm going to check this out. And then I hadn't thought about Scooby-Doo in forever. And then all of a sudden, one day, Cartoon Network announces that they're going to be releasing, like, the straight-to-VHS film. They're going to air it on Cartoon Network. And that's where I first saw Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island. And that show... It made me love Scooby Doo again.
That trailer,
so I think it captured
that original trailer for Zombie Island.
Yeah, the trailer was awesome.
I think generated more excitement for Scooby Doo than people had seen in like a decade. The animation by Mook was beautiful, and the scene where Fred pulls the head off the zombie, I was like, I need to see this. Like, this is going to be amazing.
I remember that's like, because that was part of the trailer, like them hopping the zombie around. Like, the monsters are real. I remember that line from the trailer. But, and I thoroughly enjoy this property, this iteration, because I think it captured the spirit of the original one while kind of, I guess, not doing anything new, because 13 Ghosts of Scooby-Doo did that whole thing of like the monsters are real. But this one, it kind of gave us a good storyline too, right? In which, in a sort of way, you're kind of empathetic towards the bad guys, because all they're doing is just, you know, they're in the spell because they were trying to get revenge on, you know, pirates that slaughtered their people, you know? But this was easily one of my favorite Scooby-Doo properties that I remember still, like, and I just rewatching it, it still holds up.
It's such an interesting thing in the franchise's history, because it was an IP that Warner Brothers hadn't really exploited for, I think, 7 or 8 years. And they were just kind of looking for stuff to do. And they were like, what about Scooby-Doo? Like, we keep talking about sort of public perception and how everybody sort of thinks things are compared to how they actually were at the time. This is one of those things where nobody gave a rat's ass about Scooby-Doo. Mm-hmm. And they had their group from Hanna-Barbera that were making SWAT Cats, Davis Doy, Jim Stenstrom, Glenn Leopold, and Lance Falk. They were like, here's some money, make it. You have basically creative freedom to do whatever you want, because we don't have any idea what to do with this IP. And they weren't even given like a real timeline. They said the home video department would like it around this time, but there was no plans. And the thing came out and it was bonkers. It was a high-priced home video product, because they did put some money into it. I think they retailed at like $19.99, which was a little high, but it sold gangbusters. Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh, there's money to be made here.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the studio started dictating things. And like, we haven't had a year without a Scooby-Doo direct-to-video movie since mm-hmm. 1998.
Crazy.
Without Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island, there would not be the Scooby-Doo live-action movie.
I 100% agree. You know, like, the whole franchise got, like, a jump start back, and it was back full force. And also, this is 2002, you know, 90s were really big on making movies based out of old TV shows. The Addams Family happened, the Brady Bunch happened. So I kind of feel like it was, like, eventually going to happen, but because of Zombie Island and just all the other stuff that happened after that, the revitalization of it, mm-hmm. it came. Maybe the Scooby-Doo movie came a little too late, but it came.
Yeah, it was actually in development since like 94 or something.
Yeah.
Like, it was just floating around Warner Brothers for a long time. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I think it did come like just a smidge too late.
I think so. I think so.
Wait, did they have like actual casting yet in 1994, or was it just an idea? Or did they have like casting ideas? I want to know, like, who were they thinking of like casting? Because the 90s stars versus the early 2000s stars are very
different.
Yes. Oh, actually, interestingly enough, I've got Wikipedia open on the 2002 movie, and literally under my Skype screen, it's the casting area. it says Jim Carrey was originally attached to play Shaggy, with Mike Myers also expressing interest in the role, but I think that was still closer to the 2000s.
Yeah.
That is way too old to be Shaggy.
Yeah, I'm glad he did it.
In like, by 90s, yeah. I won't say that he won't be a good Shaggy. I'm just saying it's just like he would have been too old.
Realistically,
the cast of the movie, that's one of the fun things about the movie. The cast, they're all in like their 30s.
Yeah.
And they're playing these teenagers, but you don't care. It's not like watching 90210 where you're like, Jason Priestley looks trendy to be my dad.
Like wrinkles everywhere, yeah.
But I guess we might also start talking about Scooby-Doo 2002.
It was directed by Raja Gosnell, who up to that point actually directed Never Been Kissed, which is a 90s movie I think everyone has in their, most people have in their hearts. Not everyone, I shouldn't generalize.
The drag queen is a film director?
Raja Gosnell, but yeah. I think Raja Gosnell also did, Big Mama's House, that's right. That was the movie. So right before, Never Been Kissed, Big Mama's House, Scooby-Doo. So it's pretty good, a bunch of blockbusters, because Scooby-Doo was a big financial success. Whether the critical success, but the cast for the live-action film is Freddie Prinze Jr. plays Fred Jones, Sarah Michelle Gellar plays Daphne, Linda Cardellini plays Velma, and Matthew Lillard plays Shaggy, the most 90s cast ever for a 2002 movie. And the voice, unfortunately, Don Messick, who was just a great voice actor for Scooby-Doo, had passed away in 1997. But the voice for Scooby-Doo was done by Scott Inez this time. Now, I'd like to just give a shout out really quick to Frank Welker, who has been doing the voice of Fred Jones since the 1969 version of Scooby-Doo. And he, at least for the animated TV shows, hasn't stopped doing Freddy. He's even in Be Cool Scooby-Doo. And now he's also doing the voice of Scooby-Doo.
Mike.
I need to correct you on the Scooby-Doo voice.
Who plays Scooby-Doo?
Scooby-Doo in the film was Neil Fanning.
Oh, Scott Inez is Scrappy?
He plays Scrappy, yes.
Got it mixed up. Thank you.
Neil Fanning was actually... The movie was filmed in Australia.
Uh-huh.
And Neil Fanning was a friend of one of, like, the production assistants or something. And they were like... They were looking for someone to do Scooby's voice on set.
Okay.
And they were like, well, I know this guy. He can kind of do it. And they're like, okay. So they brought Neil Fanning in, and he would do the voice on set for the actors to respond to. And they just liked it so much that they were like, I guess you're Scooby-Doo in the movie. And he has a small cameo at the Tiki Bar, I think.
Oh.
Sorry. That's in Monsters Unleashed. He's in the Villains Bar.
Okay.
Sitting there just as one of the drunken layabouts.
Wow, yeah. I didn't get to Monsters Unleashed. Did you, Rolando?
I saw parts of it when it actually came out, like when it came onto, they released it on cable and stuff, but mm-hmm. I never really got into it.
Okay.
It's actually funny. A recent scene just kind of showed up that I assumed was like hinting. I haven't seen the movie, but it looked like it was hinting that like maybe Velma was struggling with sexuality and had a crush on Daphne. I might just be reading into that. But like it was a scene where like they're both crawling around on the floor, and then like she's just like, you need to talk about your sexual tension. And they kind of like look like they're about to kiss. But again, I could be reading into it.
You're not reading into it.
Oh, I'm not.
Oh,
okay,
awesome.
Good. See? Tell me more.
So there are several myths that have sort of developed within fan community or head canons, I guess, over the years. Shaggy and Scooby are stoners. That I'm actually not a fan of, because as Nicole said, Shaggy was based on Maynard G. Krebs. Joe Ruby was actually very anti-drugs back in 1969. Like, I think these characters are very malleable, and you can code a lot of things, or you can like insert a lot of things or attribute a lot of things. But that's one of the things. It's just a low-hanging fruit. And I prefer the characters not being just stoners. I don't know. There's something about that just bothers me.
I'm with you.
Another one is that Daphne and Velma sort of kind of have something going on. And
not Fred and Velma, Daphne? I always thought it was Fred and Daphne.
Daphne and Velma also comes up because in the very first episode, which was, I think it was a Night for Night. Maybe it's a different one.
It is, yeah.
The one where Daphne's all tied up, right? That kind of has made the rounds online where Daphne's tied up. She's like moaning. She's like, Velma's just like, that's Daphne. And someone postulates. She's like, how does Velma know what Daphne sounds when she's tied up and grunting?
Wow, I didn't think about it like that.
There is that idea that when everybody splits up, it's usually Velma, Shaggy, and Scooby, mm-hmm. and Fred and Daphne. And they're like, oh, Fred and Daphne are going off to the Bob Ugly's.
Yeah.
But I ask, whenever I talk to somebody who's worked on like the older shows, I like to ask them about, you know, that headcanon that fans have developed over the last 50 years and what they think of it. And I was talking to the story editor for the Scooby-Doo Scrappy-Doo show. And as I'm going through, I'm like, you know, the stoners. And he's just like, no, that was never even, we never even as writers and animators were like, we're going to slip this in. And then I was like, Daphne and Velma, and he was like, oh, yeah.
That's funny.
James Gunn, one of the interesting things about this movie is that James Gunn was basically creating a movie based on all of these headcanon things, like whether you like them or not. Like Fred was a total jock. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of a jerk too. And I don't think the Fred in this movie really represents sort of who Fred is in the series.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree.
Acne was so girly girl. And
I will argue for Daphne. They tried to balance her out by trying to... She was trying to fight the fact that she was a damsel in distress. Like, that was her story arc. They were trying to address that. I don't know to what effect they actually succeeded with that one, because it's funny. When I first saw this movie, I actually... It was okay. It was fine. It's not something I'll ever think... I didn't think about it again until we had to do the podcast, and I rewatched it. And, man, Sarah Michelle Gellar's acting as Daphne, not the best.
Well,
neither was Freddie Prinze Jr., to be honest. I think the best ones were
Velma and Shaggy.
Yes, exactly. And the fact that, like, Freddie Prinze Jr. got top billing over Matthew Lillard is a disgrace.
That's true. Well, I will say one thing about the movie, and it might have been my copy, but the movie had really poor sound editing to it. A lot of the lines of dialogue did not match up with their lips.
Oh, interesting. That might have been... I think
that was probably your copy.
Yeah.
Well, it was... I mean, I stopped it. I went back to it. But also, just in general, like, I didn't really... I think the sound editing was just kind of off in that movie.
Stop torrenting movies, Nicole. Killing the industry.
Please, I bought that for $3.
Oh, so did I. Okay. So then get your money back and complain.
Yeah, I want my $3 back. But I'm an editor, so I think I'm annoying, and I notice those things, like, really, really quickly. But I think Matthew Lillard as Shaggy is kind of the saving grace in this movie, and I really... This film is the one that sets up the friendship between and puts a lot of the spotlight on Shaggy and Scoob's friendship, especially at the moment at the end where everyone's kind of like looking for their loved one and they like look for each other and they embrace. I thought that was actually really cute, because that's the movie that establishes how much these two just like are bonded and they love each other. And he's just kind of like the closest to his original character. He believes in friendship and he wants them all to stick together. And somehow Fred, Daphne, and even Velma all became kind of egotistical and assholes in this version, where they split up in the beginning, because the first 5 minutes had promise and then that scene happened. I was like, what is going on?
So I'm actually glad you brought this up, because this is one of the issues I actually take up with this movie.
Yeah.
In which, and this isn't me comparing it to Zombie Island, where Zombie Island kind of gives me a fair reason as to why the gang splits up. It's the fact that like they got tired of like hunting, finding men in masks. All right. And so what happens with Daphne? She decides to start a TV show hunting for real ghosts. Freddie becomes her video producer, and the rest of the team kind of just splits up. But they still remain friends.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This one, they had to split, and then you had to do that awkward thing of kind of like reuniting them at a certain point.
Yeah.
Where had they kind of just gone the route of Zombie Island, which it was just friends who kind of just like drifted ways, and they're back together, and they're like, oh, they want to be here. That would have been an easier write-up, and also it would have been an easier pill to swallow if they had just stayed friends and they just kind of just
100%.
As most friends do as you grow up.
Definitely. I agree with you. And I actually don't think that I don't think every single character other than I think only Shaggy and Scooby were pretty okay written. I don't like Velma in this movie. I'll take a pause because I hear it really strong on my end.
Oh, I'm not talking, so you could just cut me out.
True. I don't like Velma in this movie, mainly because I don't think that someone as smart and as rational kind of like needs to be put the spotlight. Like when Freddie's like, oh, well, first of all, I don't believe that Freddie would be like, hey, I'm the teen heartthrob and the whole world is obsessed with me. But I don't think that Velma would be standing there being like, I wish my face was on a magazine. Like, I don't think she's about that. And it just seems so like character, like it's not a character trait that I also associate with someone who's so smart and so rational.
I didn't read that Velma was just after the spotlight, though. I think she just wanted credit where credit is due. It was her idea. Freddie's taking the spot. Not taking the spotlight.
But they didn't do that. But they didn't do that. It wasn't Freddie giving her the credit. It was him being like, hey, the world, TV, cameras, put it on Velma. So that's what it seemed like she wanted. She didn't even want Freddie to, like, you know, clap her on the back. And then they had a moment where they could do that, where they're all kind of like there on the beach. But the only thing that Velma gets is that she gets a nickname. I mean, I didn't even know Fred gave nicknames, you know? So it was like this weird thing where it's like, well, what are you looking for yourself, Velma? And they just kind of make her out to be someone who's curmudgeon-y in her own way and just doesn't like get enough love because she wears glasses or something. Like, I don't even know why they decided to put Velma that way. They just make her kind of like a grump.
The thing that throws me about this movie, because I do find it entertaining. I do feel it as kind of like this alternate universe, bizarro world kind of version of the characters. They're kind of caricatures of the characters.
Yeah.
As I said, James Gunn is very much feeding off of the headcanon that's been developed. And he's going after a lot of really low-hanging fruit. It's a really lazy plot device to break the gang up, like Rolando said. Something that they keep going back to. It's so much easier, or not so much easier, it's so much more rewarding to start from a point of, if you're going to talk about friendship, like, challenge the friendship.
Yep.
From within while they're like still together rather than
immediately. Yes.
Yeah. It's,
they just come off as assholes, essentially, in my opinion.
They kind of do. And it's funny, 'cause like, I mean, I do actually like James Gunn. I think he's a nice person. I do like his films, but when you look at Scooby-Doo and Scooby-Doo Monsters Unleashed, and you look at Guardians of the Galaxy and Guardians of the Galaxy 2, it's kind of the same structure.
Yeah.
True. That's true.
So, he's the writer for both those films, by the way, guys.
Yes, he is. Just to give Rolando some closure on the Velma Daphne thing, it's widely known this film was originally supposed to be a much stronger PG-13 or an R-rated film. It was going to have a little more body humor, B-A-U-D-Y, not B-O-D-Y. And Velma and Daphne, I think when they were doing all the body switching and stuff, there was going to be like a same-sex kiss. And there was just going to be a lot of like allusions, like sort of subtext, that maybe while the gang, you know, wasn't together, Velma and Daphne had hooked up or something.
Right.
Yeah, without that scene kind of seemed pointless, but I mean, you know, whatever. There was a lot of stuff in that movie. I will say, though, that the scariest part of this movie was that scene with Sugar Ray.
Oh, yeah.
Performing on the beach. And then with those eyes, because, you know, Sugar Ray, just full 90s glory. And I was like, oh, my God, this movie. And Pamela Anderson,
yeah. How is this movie was so dated with the red? Oh, I also had a question. Is that what people dressed like in the early aughts? I don't remember. I guess I was
a lot of belly shirts.
As a high school student,
yeah.
But like all the spiky hair and those baggy clothes. Is that what people really wore? I guess because, you know, I was like only in high school when this movie came out.
I don't know. You're the Britney fan, and that was like Britney era. What was she wearing?
I guess it's true. Yeah. The spiky.
Yeah. Oops, I did it again. You know. So
I got, you know, I just, it's funny, right? Because I was just thinking, it's just like, I didn't dress like that, but I was always just trying to just blend in. You know, you're a gay kid growing up in high school. You just want to just fit in and not really.
True. Well, you were a boy, really, so.
Yes, that's also true.
You guys bring up another interesting point, though, when you mentioned the Pamela Anderson and the Sugar Ray. It's like, when it comes to theatrical releases, there seems to be this concern, and I think it comes more from the studio, to hip it up. And they like to throw in all of these like contemporary references and contemporary actors and stuff to kind of, you know, the kids will like it. And it's like, Scooby-Doo's been around for so long, you either have to go to something completely new and completely redefine it, or you need to really, like, honor what it was and what it started with. Because, obviously, that concept is indestructible. And they keep walking this line. And they want to make it hip, and they want to change it, but they don't want to change it. And I think that's where they always falter.
Yes, I agree.
Well, actually, no. So it's funny. I actually always thought that that the reason you bring in some of these guest stars, like Sugar Ray, like Pamela Anderson, I thought they were homage to the fact that like Scooby-Doo had this honor tradition of having these celebrities like lend their voices and
like
be
Don
guest
Knotts,
stars on the show. Yeah, exactly. So that's what I always thought. Like when I first saw this, I was like, okay, I guess they're doing it like when Batman and Robin and Josie and the Pussycats came out, right? Like these are names that we know and stuff. But actually, before we can move on to the next one, I did want to get Eddie's opinion because he thought he had seen this movie, and then it turns out as we were rewatching it, he's just like, "No, I never had seen this movie. I am mistaken." So, Eddie, what were your fresh thoughts on the film as a brand new viewer? And this is like
as
in the last like, couple of hours.
I was totally surprised in the sense of like, how did I miss this film? Because being a big fan of Freddie Prinze Jr. and Sarah Michelle Gellar. I was like, hey, how did I miss this? But yeah, I actually enjoyed it. I do see your point, how it could be very much characters of these characters. But what I did enjoy compared to, I haven't seen a lot of the different versions besides the original Scooby-Doo and A Pup Named Scooby-Doo. But the idea of having these characters besides Shaggy and Scooby, that the other characters were interacting with each other. Mm-hmm. Like seeing scenes with Daphne and Fred or Velma, you know, having them interact with each other. Because I feel like you never get in the cartoons, for me, looking back at them now, that you never kind of get like any character growth. You know, I think the one thing that I did see that when I was looking at the original, I was trying to like pick up something new. And one of the things that I picked up was that Shaggy was a gymnast, like a very like the most like the best gymnast in high school. I think it was in the pilot because he was able to do this backflip or something to get into the museum. So yeah, I just thought that was cool. But I enjoyed the film more than I thought I was going to. Like, and I was like, well, how did I miss this? I enjoyed it. It was pretty good for me.
Aw. Eddie's always even very positive.
I mean, even
I know, I'm super positive all the time. So,
Rolando, I want to say something to your comparison of like why Sugar Ray and Pamela Anderson were in this movie compared to like when they had like guest stars like Don Knotts. You know, there's a difference between like having Don Knotts in an episode as compared to throwing Pamela Anderson in. I feel like Don Knotts is very family friendly, wholesome, and even, you know, Yogi Bear based on Andy Griffith's show. You know, it's kind of like something that's very Hanna and Barbera, where Pamela Anderson's a very random kind of character from the 90s that you just kind of like when you throw in that doesn't really have any connection to, I feel like, not only the belief system of Scooby-Doo but the tone makes me think that Hollywood bigwigs are like, yeah, let's get Pamela Anderson in there, and like, yeah, who else? Oh, Sugar Ray, the kids love them, and it just feels like a disconnect.
But I think at the same time, though, this movie was going for that certain tone, though, right?
Like, well, Spring Breaker is on an island.
To kind of make sure that they, the rest of the, because keep in mind, the moment we see Pamela Anderson, the tone of the film completely changes immediately. Because up until that very point, like, this movie felt like it was just like, oh, it looks like they're literally doing a remake of the show in live action. And
true.
Then Pamela Anderson shows up and all of a sudden it's just like, wait, where are we? What are we?
Oh, now we're on a 90s spring break movie.
Now we're like
in
the real world almost. And and I think, you know, I don't know. It was trying to go. So for me, this movie kind of felt like, and I wish it had been a little smarter, but like, you remember Brady Bunch, right? One of the reasons I think Brady Bunch succeeds is because they take the original concept of the original family and they just shove them into the 90s, but they don't change anything else about them. So it's kind of like
contrast,
culture shock between it's a culture shock between how we used to envision life in the 60s right, versus the 90s. And they could have done that here a little bit. They didn't. They just decided to go it's just like, all right, so these are just these teenagers from like the early aughts and this is their stories and stuff.
True.
So that's just, you know,
again,
it could have been smarter. But I think overall, an enjoyable film.
Nicole was talking about how A Pup Named Scooby-Doo kind of set up a lot of things for what would sort of come. Coolsville came from A Pup Named Scooby-Doo.
Yes, yes.
Coolsville is what's used in the film.
Mm-hmm.
But also, being of an age where I wasn't just a kid and I wasn't just kind of a bitter adult, when I saw this movie in the theater, actually being there when it happened and living through a certain amount of Scooby-Doo history, this movie at the time, like I look back on it and have these feelings about it, but at the time, this movie was smart. It was funny. It was clever. It was deconstructing the thing. It was like, this was everything we kind of wanted from this at the time. This was like the Adult Swim, you know, Harvey Birdman, Space Ghost Coast to Coast kind of version of Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
And looking back on it, it feels like a misfire now.
For sure.
And still entertaining, but a misfire in terms of sort of longevity and like the legacy of the film. And are people going to revisit this film and be like this is the live action Scooby-Doo movie I always wanted kind of thing. It's very much of its time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think that for me seeing this in 2020 as myself looking at it for the very first time, I have a completely different perception of it.
Like I said, they were trying to be smart at certain times. Like when you mentioned the fact that like they were, you know, kind of they served into the fact like kind of tongue in cheek about that they were potheads, right? One of those early scenes in the film is the fact that we see the mystery machine like with plumes of smoke coming out. And it turns out they were just grilling inside the van. The girl that he meets, her name is Mary Jane. And he's like, oh my God, I love Mary Jane.
Yeah.
It's just like, all right, we get it.
Yes.
They were
I appreciated that.
Do you know the history behind vegetarianism?
Casey Kasem.
Yes. Yep. That's a fascinating history all of its own. And Matthew Lillard's interpretation of Shaggy here, they kept that kind of tradition going.
One that they did not respect in Scoob.
Well, once Casey Kasem died, I guess they were just like, all right.
Yes.
We don't need to.
I will. Well, once Casey Kasem died, essentially, especially for the television programs, Matthew Lillard has taken over the role of Shaggy, and he has been doing it since 2010. And it's only until the Scoob film that somebody else other than Matthew Lillard played Shaggy, which I think was also kind of I'm just so used to hearing the same kind of voices. That this film was different in a weird way. I won't say if it's good or bad in more ways than one, and especially kind of like in that way. And I think now is as good as a time as ever to talk about 2020 Scoob, made by the Warner Animation Group, who's a relatively young company because their first movie was Lego Movie. Many years ago. They haven't made that many movies, and they're planning on doing a whole kind of reboot of the Hanna-Barbera properties with Tom and Jerry scheduled to be released in Christmas. This is their first one. Yeah, I'm intrigued.
It doesn't have like this idea, like people don't have ideas invested in what Tom and Jerry is, so I think they have the freedom to kind of
definitely
do whatever.
Just play with it, yeah.
And they're already trying to cross over worlds because we got a bunch of Wacky Races references in this film. But before,
there were way more in the development of this movie.
Oh, really?
Well, okay. So Scoob, voices. Here we go. We got for Scooby-Doo. We got Frank Welker, who's been doing the voice of Scooby-Doo since Don Messick died. Who's also the voice of Fred Jones, but not in this movie. For Fred Jones in this movie, we have Zac Efron. For Daphne, we have Amanda Seyfried, and Gina Rodriguez makes Velma Dinkley the first time we've seen Velma as a Spanish woman, because she says increíble at one point.
Let's talk about that a little bit. I have opinions. Okay.
I think that was kind of like a politically correct choice to make. You know, did I hate it? No, but was it completely necessary? No, but also I like that they made the character that wasn't white the most important member, kind of. Not actually in this movie. I think those three aren't very strong, and they're not in it as much, which is also kind of a bummer.
That is a problem with the movie. But no, yeah. In terms of like actually introducing Gina Rodriguez Gina Rodriguez as the voice of Velma. So the only reason I kind of took issue with it is because it felt like really, really like just shoved in there, though.
Yes.
It didn't feel organic. It didn't feel like it was part of the story in any sense, in any logical way. Even the character design for Velma didn't. I mean, granted, like, you know, Latin people, we can come in all sorts of shapes and colors. So, yeah. Like, I can't fault them on that. But it was just the one word, increíble. I'm supposed to say, oh, she's Latina now. So now it's like, okay, now it's great.
But at the same time, too, that's kind of the real world. We don't walk around saying, oh, I'm Puerto Rican. I don't come to my group and I'm saying, hey, I'm the Spanish guy of my group. You know, I feel like we don't always have to, I don't always have the need for my characters to self-identify themselves, you know, like saying like, hey, I'm the Latino of this group, you know, or I'm going to be extra and speak Spanish whenever I can. It's just, you know, you recognize, hey, this is the individual, his background, Latino. Yeah. With Velma, I mean, she said one word and that's the only thing I caught on. I was like, oh, wait a minute. Did they do that? I think that's kind of cool. You know, that's kind of cool. Like maybe a little diversity. Did I need it? Not per se, not for this particular character. Can I appreciate it? Yeah, a little bit.
It didn't do anything other than normalize it, which is why I'm kind of like on the fence, because it didn't need to happen, but it was nice to have. So
it's fair.
I think being on the fence with something in this movie is, it's pretty much, at least for me, it goes with almost everything. Because like using the example of Velma, it's kind of in her design. You can see that, you know, she's been subtly kind of altered to fit a more, you know, Latina kind of look. They've got Gina Rodriguez doing the voice, and it's there. Like it's visual, it's audio, but then they have to go, you know, here's the big fist of ham. We're going to put one more thing in there just so that you can see, we did this. It's not as subtle as it could be. And I think because it's not as subtle as it could be, it feels a little more disingenuous, but it's still a more progressive way to approach the character. So you're kind of like, I like what they're doing, but I also feel a little bit weird about what they're doing. And
yeah.
That's pretty much how I felt.
And I mean, I just want to say it's kind of one of those instances where like Disney does this all the time where they introduce a gay character for like two frames and it's just like, we introduce diversity.
Yeah.
And it's just like, Jesus Christ, just don't do it at all, or actually just commit.
Yeah.
That's all I need. Just a little commitment here.
But yeah, so I really liked the beginning of this movie. And it kind of gives you the backstory on how Shaggy and Scooby met, and then how Shaggy and Scooby met the rest of the mystery gang. And I think that opening, when they're all kids and they're all trick-or-treating and they just kind of stumble into a quote-unquote haunted house, is a very nice tribute to the original series.
Isn't there the way they're costumed during the Halloween scene is character-based?
Yeah.
I love that. It's one of those subtle moments that they don't hit you with the ham, right?
Yeah. Yes,
wearing
the
suit of armor. Velma's wearing the Ruth Bader Ginsburg outfit.
Loved.
Daphne
was Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
And Shaggy and Scooby are wearing, you know, the best friends, right? Like.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then they stumble into a haunted house only to find out that it was actually an illegal ring of selling media properties or whatever. I forgot what that was, but.
It was like a ring of stolen, like, appliances.
Merchandise,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Like TVs and stuff.
So instantly, okay, you know, this is going to follow the original show. But then it does what kind of like the last film does, was it kind of honors that now Scooby-Doo isn't like, okay, we believe in the natural world. We believe that there is the supernatural world. It's kind of like the in-between ambiguous, like some things can be explained, some things can't be explained. And that's kind of what Scooby-Doo has become. And this movie, although I think it leads very much more towards the supernatural, it tries to be in like ever present in the very in between of those two worlds, which I kind of prefer Scooby-Doo when it's more like everything can be explained and there's a natural reason for everything. Like after Zombie Island, when it pretty much dedicates itself to supernatural, I kind of feel like, I don't know, it kind of loses some of the things that I at least loved about it. Which is
for the movies, I would say, because I think some of the TV movies. Show Mysteries Inc. is a show that kind of
follows more the natural one.
The only difference being that it kind of gave it a more sweeping overall story arc.
Yeah,
which hadn't been done with Scooby-Doo, to my knowledge. Like, I guess 13 Ghosts of Scooby-Doo was overall story arc, but that was still, you know, serialized as far as I'm concerned. This one, you know, Mystery Inc. from what I had seen, it looks like it just it kind of gives it like everyone. I mean, it starts off. I mean, one of the main storylines already in the first couple of episodes was the fact that, like, Shaggy and Velma are in a relationship that's a secret. And I was just like, oh, so scandalous.
But, okay, so back to Scoob. they meet. They're like, oh, my God, why don't we keep doing this? And this cute little montage happens of them doing it. And then all of a sudden, they're at a diner. And Simon Cowell pays them a visit. Which
again,
is
following that time-honored tradition of just random irrelevant guest stars.
I hated this one more than Pamela Anderson and Sugar Ray, let me say that. But Simon Cowell is just like, I'll invest in you guys if you drop Shaggy and Scooby. And the three of them, Fred, Velma, and Daphne, there just seems to be this weird disconnect that happens. It's not very well written where they decide, we're going to do this without you guys. They just kind of leave and then they're taken apart kind of weirdly, indefinitely. I don't know. It's just, it doesn't work. And it doesn't really make sense.
Can I give you my joke I have for the Simon Cowell cameo?
Yes, please.
here's my show notes, guys, for it, or my note. It's Simon Cowell. That cameo.
Mind you, wait. Can I just phrase? He said, "I'm gonna be like Nicole. I'm gonna take notes while I'm watching it."
Yeah, here are my notes. See.
But my notes turn out to be like more like writing material for jokes. All right, so let me see if this works. Simon Cowell. That cameo is like 15 years too late. Also, I'm glad to see his plastic surgery succeeded in this world.
Oh. And the library is closed.
I read the junior novelization before the movie came out, and in the junior novelization, it's like a team building expert. It's like an efficiency expert or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the gang is thinking about going into kind of business, and they're looking for investors, and so they're getting this evaluation, and it's all the same dialogue. And I'm tempted to believe that because it's a novelization, it was based on an early script.
Right.
So I think Simon Cowell was like a late get And it's like, oh, let's put someone famous in this rather than just some no-name, you know,
terrible
bureaucratic whatever.
Yeah.
And it's endemic of, I think, what's wrong with what we already talked about, the theatrical films, with just let's hip them up. Let's put, you know, popular songs or references in the haunted house where they open the curtains and they're looking at all the stolen television stuff.
Yes.
It's like, oh, it's like there's a whole Walmart back here. It's like, why'd you have to say Walmart? Why couldn't you just say electronics store? Like, why did
That's because Walmart paid for that plug there, you know?
Well, that was another thing that I really hated about this movie was at one point, Dick Dastardly, who's the villain in this movie, who I thought was a cute choice because I actually really like Joaquin Reyes. He's looking at them and he makes a comment about them being mauling millennials or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he referred to the Scooby Gang as millennials drives me fucking crazy. And this whole movie turns them into one hell of a millennial. I mean, the first thing, one before Shaggy maybe even speaks, he's listening to the Backstreet Boys on his iPod. I mean, I got what they were doing with that reference because Scooby-Doo is from all these decades.
But millennial isn't even the accurate definition for them because I think they're technically Generation Z.
I mean, at this point, they're kind of timeless. But
I mean, yeah, sure, but I mean,
just, all generations.
But I
they're
felt
teenagers.
I felt like, and this is my personal thing, is that kind of setting them into one decade and then making that like right now was, I think, a bad choice, because I did not resonate with those characters the moment they kind of like made. They just didn't seem like who I've grown to love them for in this past week. that I've been doing this for. I kind of
thank you for clarifying.
I mean, even what they're wearing and the fucking van that they're in is just so clearly of the 60s and stuff that it's like either refer to them as like kind of like respect what they were born out of or just don't refer to it at all. But they kind of made them and making the millennials like, what kind of millennials wear that? What kind of millennials, you know, drive around in that kind of van? It felt
the cool kind.
It felt kind of like
ironic ones.
Or the ironic ones, are obsessed with nostalgia. Maybe, but it also just kind of felt like the people who were in charge of this movie, it just felt very, very uneven, and it didn't feel really thought out for me.
I will say that I think this movie went through a lot of iterations, and I think this movie had a lot of studio oversight. It's basically been in development, I think, for like 5 years. And a lot of people have come on to contribute to it, some successfully, some not successfully. I'm kind of looking at the movie at this point as I'm amazed it's kind of as cohesive and entertaining as it is for what it is. Because I've heard some stories. I've talked to some people, and you see the concept art that's going around Twitter right now. There's so many artists, like a ridiculous amount of artists doing character studies, doing color script things, tone images, and they're beautiful and they're amazing. And the wacky racist characters and the Hanna-Barbera characters. And it's like, there's even a, it was recently released. They did it's like a couple minute short where they were just trying to sort of nail the tone of it and to show what the characters would look like in CG, where the Falcon Fury sort of shows up like a UFO would to kind of like abduct Shaggy and Scooby. And it looks great. And I'm like, wow, I wish the movie was this, but the movie's so brightly lit. And it's I'm not sure where I'm going. Oh, yeah, the development
shiny.
Of the movie.
It's a shiny movie.
I think it was pulled in a lot of different directions, and I think they weren't allowed the room to breathe. I think this movie could easily be another 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I'm just going to... So I'm like, what's it called? I mean, breaking that fourth wall, but like, you know, before I talked with Mike, we talked to him before we recorded this episode, and he kind of gave me that little background information on the movie without trying to spoil anything. But I caught it actually at the credits. And this is just something from listening to Script Notes, which is a podcast about screenwriting, and just like, you know, just reading in terms of like the actual industry. But anytime a film has four screenwriters listed, it's a sign of trouble. No,
yes.
And this is actual fact, because usually those are only the four that the Writers Guild will give credit for. But you can guarantee the moment there are four, and it's been in development hell, there are several more writers under that
for sure.
Get any credit. And
it's
that
like
means
the
that it was
movie.
Just a so I yeah. So
yeah.
The Flintstones movie from the '90s. There's four credited writers, mm-hmm. but there was like 33 writers that worked on that movie.
Crazy. Yeah. Hanna-Barbera turned into movies is just kinda hard, it seems.
I don't hate the Flintstones movie.
I don't either, but I think it suffers from the same things that kind of what we're talking about now suffers from.
For sure.
It's been a while since I've seen it.
Hopefully they remake it so we can talk about that movie.
Well, okay, so it makes sense that there were so many people who kind of contributed to this script because there was a moment in this movie that really kind of just is when it lost me. And it was halfway through, or maybe even a little bit past the halfway point. And it's definitely hitting one of the eight-point story structures where there's a rift between Shaggy and Scooby, and it felt just so incredibly out of character that it actually really hurt me. It was where Shaggy's jealous of everything that's happening with Scooby, and they're fighting, and he's like, you can't go off with them, we don't do that. And Scooby's like, I want to go off with them. And then he's like, well, you have to choose. And Shaggy gives Scooby-Doo an ultimatum. And first of all, the fact that Scooby-Doo, I think, would leave Shaggy in the first place is just so uncharacteristic, and I don't buy it. It's very against who I think Scooby-Doo is supposed to stand for, even. But the fact that Shaggy would give him an ultimatum, I was offended.
I feel like I've given my dog ultimatums when he was alive all the time. And he would pick Eddie or you when you were in the house and
stuff.
So I relate. I can relate to Shaggy being jealous of other people and your dog giving them all the attention. Because dogs are kind of attention whores.
This is a different. This is his best friend. This is like his only friend, apparently.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, they've gone through everything together.
It was set up early on with the "we're never going to be apart" and
yeah,
here's the collar that I got for you. And it's like,
they could have done it better.
Miles coming away. Yeah.
That part really deeply. That was one of the times where I was like, this is just so uncharacteristic. It's almost as if these people haven't watched that many episodes of Scooby-Doo. Because I just feel like that would never happen.
The guys who directed the movie made Mystery Incorporated.
Crazy.
Really?
Like Tony Cervone and Spike Grant, they were the guys who created Mystery Incorporated, which is one of the best incarnations of Scooby-Doo ever.
It lost me kind of after that. I do like Daphne in this movie. I think, especially with kind of the new TV shows, with Be Cool Scooby-Doo and Scooby-Doo and Guess Who? I really appreciate how this day and age has kind of shown a light on Daphne, realized that she's more than just a pretty girl, and that they scraped the whole spoiled brat thing, and that they went with more, in Be Cool Scooby-Doo, she's very quirky. She's very millennial quirky, which is really nice about her.
Zooey Deschanel.
Okay, sure.
I'm just saying, that was like our go-to quirky girl.
That was like 5 years ago, though. But and in this one, I think that she is definitely the heart and soul. She's the one who bonds with Scooby immediately. You know, he licks her face and stuff in the beginning. And I think that with Velma being the one who's so smart and Freddy kind of going all over the place in this movie.
Freddy was pansexual. Yeah. Because he was into Dick Dastardly dressed as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And he was really confused about his feelings.
And he felt too much emotion to the car that he's a sexual deviant, in my opinion.
Yes.
That's the route they went with Freddy.
I believe
that's that. That was also one of my workshop jokes here.
That was pretty good. I'm glad you're getting deliver these jokes. but yeah, so I will say that that's one of the things that overall, just like with kind of the 21st century, has come this new kind of showing Daphne to be like actually a character that's worth being part of the gang, because a lot of people have in the past, I think, not thought that about her. Other than that, though, I was really disappointed because, first of all, also the Scooby-Doo 2002 movie really hit the nail on the Shaggy Scooby friendship. So this movie was trying to do that, but it wasn't telling us anything new. And then they did a lot of things that were uncharacteristic. So they get points off for me for doing that.
I think there were some things that they did that were lazy in the sense that, and again, when I say lazy, I'm not saying that these people aren't, you know, creative or talented or whatever, but they had the 90 minutes to work with, and I think they were, rather than building actual scenes to create the emotional dynamics of the characters and the conflicts and the whatever, they just throw in like a line or two, and we have 50 years of Scooby-Doo history to draw on where we know these characters and whatever, and they're like, we don't have to explain it because everybody knows what it is. And you end up with more plot than scenes.
Okay, so I think this movie did some things right. For me, the thing that comes to mind is easily Dick Dastardly. And his, again, I empathize a lot with the villain here, right? His, like, kind of wanting to go to the end of the world to save his dog, Money.
That was cute. Yeah.
All right, this is a motivation where I'm just like, I'm empathetic. Okay. Dick Dastardly might have saved this whole film, to be totally honest.
Jason Isaacs was brilliant as Dick Dastardly.
Yeah, he was. Dick Dastardly was good. Yeah. I mean, I'm also going to acknowledge that this film was, I feel like the prime demographic here was children. I think that this is a children's movie. This is not meant for Scooby-Doo fans. So I think maybe in that case, I'm being a little too harsh. And I think that it's actually a cute, charming film for kids. But I also think that it would have been nice if it was equally kind of for kids and for the diehard Scooby-Doo fans who are well into adulthood. And that was one of the things that it lacked. Yeah, for the parents. Yeah. But c'est la vie. So this is usually the part where we kind of look at all the revival properties, because I think that they're revivals, in my opinion, kind of reboots maybe, but more so revivals. And we ask ourselves if we think that this was needed. I'm going to sit on my answer for a second. Anybody else want to say whether or not they think that the Scooby-Doo live action and the Scoob movie were necessary components to the Scooby-Doo franchise?
Both of them? I think we should just stick to Scoob.
You think it's just Scoob?
I think so. Because Scooby, what's it called? I don't think anyone could ever say that the 2002 was needed, but it happened.
Okay. Sure, sure. Then let's talk about just Scoob.
Answer.
Well, since we're in 2020 and since we got this right now, it's pretty fresh. You know, let's speak about whether or not that we needed this remake for 2020.
I think need is a strong word.
Yeah, need is a very strong word.
It's always a strong word when we talk about this stuff. But I think I don't think I needed it, but I do enjoy the fact that my nieces and nephews are going to enjoy it. That this is something that's going to get their attention. And it's just like, it, you know, it adds to another generation who are going to fall in love with Scooby-Doo and the Scooby gang, you know?
Yeah.
So in that sense, yeah. So I don't say I needed it. It was semi-fun to watch. But I think it's just for another, for a younger generation.
Mike, what do you feel?
I kind of agree with Eddie in that this was a way to introduce this franchise to a younger audience in a way that it maybe hadn't been before. And also, this movie was using the most popular kind of Hanna-Barbera IP right now to introduce more Hanna-Barbera IP. Mm-hmm. And I think there were mistakes made in how that was handled and how that was marketed. I love the fact that they very successfully brought in some characters. Ken Jeong is Dynamite. I love it.
He was good. That was another good one. Yeah.
I think some of the stuff with Brian as Blue Falcon didn't quite work. Although I know that was supposed to mirror like the Scooby Shaggy thing. Captain Caveman. I love the idea of it. I love the design of it, and I love Tracy Morgan as the voice of it. But I hate the writing of it.
Yeah.
And Dick Dastardly, we already said, was amazing. Seeing Muttley just made my heart like.
Yeah, I know.
Three sizes.
I love his laugh.
And from what I'm hearing, kids are loving this movie. And
that's good.
And not everything is going to be made for me. Mm-hmm. And I accept that. I'm able to step out of the way. There's still a direct-to-video movie or two a year. There's still a TV series that's pretty much always perpetually running. I've always argued on my podcast, if you don't like this version of Scooby-Doo, there are other versions for you, and you can even go back and revisit the ones that you love. If this creates something more, like I think my biggest disappointment with Scoob was I kept seeing the potential of it and the shortcomings and how good it could have been. Like this could have been the Lego movie of Scooby-Doo and Hanna-Barbera, right? Where everybody's just like, I had no idea it could be this amazing. So, need no, but I'm glad it happened. I'm glad people are responding well to it. And I hope it leads to better things.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the franchise is indestructible. It'll survive this, whatever your feelings are.
That it is.
Yes.
Yeah, So I kind of am in the boat of I think this franchise is only needed if only like what happened with me in A Pup Named Scooby-Doo, where kids see this and then they'll just like inevitably come across all the other stuff that's out there, and hopefully, you know, it'll just make the franchise continue to just keep going. However, I don't know, I still don't know if that means that this one was itself needed, only because, as even Mike pointed out, there are still series that are still running right now that people can check out on Scooby-Doo. Is there a current Scooby-Doo running right now? Oh, is that the one with like the guest stars, like Sia's in it? I think it's in an episode. Okay, see, guest stars. Yeah. So I think for me, the problem with this one, why I don't think this is needed, is because one of the things about Scooby-Doo that I think this movie got wrong, and same thing with the 2002 version, is kind of making Scooby-Doo a chosen character. Right, he is chosen for something. He is a pure heart in the 2002 movie. In this one, he is the descendant. Thank you, of a Peridas, which is, you know, the dog for Alexander the Great. And I think that takes away from something that is important in Scooby-Doo. Like Scooby-Doo and even Shaggy, right? Anything that they do, they choose to do. They choose to go on these adventures. They're not chosen by some higher being or anything, right? They go on these adventures sometimes unwillingly because of their friends, but they still go on these adventures. And I think that's where this is why I don't think this movie itself was needed. But, you know, I don't know. At the same time, when I saw like the CGI world that is Captain Caveman, I was just like, oh, I could see this easily lending itself for a Flintstones remake. Whether or not that's going to be good, I don't know. But I thought they were going to, like, I was actually, I wanted to pause the movie while we were watching it because I wanted to see, I bet you Fred Flintstone or Barney or Betty and Wilma are here somewhere in that Coliseum.
Yeah.
But I don't have that energy to search. I promise, they're probably out there.
Yeah.
There are hundreds of Hanna-Barbera Easter eggs in this movie.
Yeah, I could imagine.
Like, every scene is just saturated. It's insane.
Yeah, my girlfriend noticed one on the billboard when they were driving. There was tons of them.
The octopus one?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, my answer is pretty much, you know, add your three answers together equals mine. I think in theory, yes. In execution, not really. But I just hope that it encourages, and this is from a selfish point of view, you know, for the last week and a half, I've divulged into this franchise and it's enjoyable. It's quite lovely. And I hope that this movie kind of inspires some people to do that. I will definitely leave it at that.
Yeah. And I know we usually end on that question about was this needed, but I actually want to ask everybody this one question.
Oh.
What they think. And that is, why do you think Scooby-Doo has lasted as long as it has? Like, I mean, if you think of long running cartoons, like even Mickey Mouse has rarely been on TV, but he's still like iconic, right? Because of Disney. Bugs Bunny, he's been on TV a lot more frequently. But Scooby-Doo has been on TV consistently, like, since its inception.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why? What do you guys think it is? What is it about Scooby-Doo that also not only has gone on for so long, but it also inspired so many knockoffs? I mean, what is it? I mean, based off of your opinions. I don't have an answer. This is all opinion based.
Yeah. I would like to hear what Mike has to say first.
I ask that question of everybody that I talk to. Not like in my daily life, but like on the podcast.
Hey, nice to meet you. What do you think about this?
The answers are pretty consistent, and I think I agree with them. And generally, it's a really simple concept. It's a really pure idea. It's about friendship. It's not cluttered with a lot of kind of archetypes and gender roles, and it's not really, I mean, it's tied to period, but it's not really tied to period. It's kind of universal. There's the mystery element, there's the comedy element, like it's just kind of this perfect storm of these things, plus it's really comfortable. And there's the idea of, you know, it's problems that are solvable, and The formula is something that I think people do draw comfort from. You can sit down and watch a Scooby-Doo episode and you kind of go along for the ride. It's like an amusement park ride, a roller coaster that you love kind of going on. It's the same ride every time, but you're just like, I like the way it twists and turns and climbs and falls and whatever.
100%. So
I think that's ultimately it. And I mean, I think the people who worked on it at the time were just firing on all cylinders. And they hit on something.
Definitely. I mean, who doesn't love a good mystery?
Mm-hmm. Eddie, do you have any thoughts?
I think what always got me too is just like, the idea of friendship, the idea of solving a mystery, you know, like being kids, mm-hmm. and we're gonna figure this out. We're gonna catch the bad guy, you know. And it's kind of funny. It's like at the end they catch the bad guy, and then the sheriff comes and arrests, you know. So it's always like they're always doing the job of the sheriff or the local law enforcement by solving all these crimes. But I just always attracted to that, you know, that like, hey, solving that mystery.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Nicole?
I mean, I just think that it's who doesn't love a good mystery, like I said. And I do think that having that nice balance of humor and, you know, and logical thinking and then supernatural elements, and it's just a kind of a perfect blend for everyone to take a bite out of. Whether you're a believer or you're a skeptic or a jackass.
Yeah.
Can I add one thing?
Yeah.
Sure.
I think also we kind of touched on this earlier where I said that the characters are, they're really defined in their friendship and kind of like who they are as personalities. But there's also just enough lack of definition that people can read stuff into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the Velma Daphne thing, right? Like if you're a queer person, you might see that and you might identify with that. I think there's stuff that you can bring to the franchise, to the characters, and invest in that isn't necessarily coded in there, but there's room to play. And I think because there's that room to play, that's part of that universality of it. And I think that's what makes it so accessible to so many people.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point for sure. Yeah, I myself don't have an answer. Only, I was just wondering, like, what do you guys think? I don't know. You guys, it's all true. Everything you guys have said. I think, I don't know. I was trying to make a profound thought, but I don't have one.
Oh, it's okay.
Could be two that we're talking.
You don't need to always have one.
Do I ever?
I can't remember who said it, but I asked somebody like why this franchise has lasted for 50 years, and they said because Warner Brothers won't let it die.
That's a great answer.
I mean, Warner, you know, they have the behemoth Disney to compete against, which is like anything that you can last as long as you can.
That and Harry Potter, just beat it, beat it.
Just yeah, milk them till they're dry.
Awesome.
But yeah, yeah. But cool. I think we are all Scooby-Dooed out. Mike, it's been a it is for me. Mike, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for asking me, man. This is fun.
Let our listeners know where they can find you.
I've got a podcast called a podcast named Scooby-Doo, digging into the history of mystery. It is a podcast for all ages and intensities. I talk to people who worked on the show, composers, writers, directors, storyboard artists. If you've touched the franchise in some way, I am there to interview you and just creating an oral history of the podcast. So if that's kind of your thing, there's some cool stories, some interesting people. That's searchable on all your podcatchers and iTunes or Apple Podcasts, all that stuff. You find it wherever you go looking for it.
And do you have social media?
I do. I'm on Twitter at ScoobyDooCast. There's the Facebook page. Instagram is, I think, the full podcast name Scooby-Doo. If you search a podcast name Scooby-Doo or ScoobyDooCast, you'll find me on most of the things.
And before we end this episode, earlier we did our own impressions of Scooby-Doo. Do you care to lend us your Scooby-Doo impression?
I'll do it.
Yeah. Go for it, mate.
Hey, we all embarrassed ourselves too, so.
There are people who do it far better than I do. I'm going to take Frank Welker's advice here. Hands on the knees.
Yeah. Wow, that was actually, really,
really good.
I love the Elvis lip thing you did too. Like,
apparently, what Frank Welker does, he says you got to loosen up the jowls, and you got to put the hands on the knees, and you got to like, yeah. You gotta create like some room for the sound around your face.
Look at that.
Nice.
Lessons learned. Well, guys, when you listen to this podcast, you will always learn something new.
Mm-hmm.
Now you guys know how to do a Scooby-Doo impression.
Yeah. If that's anything you took away from this episode, it's that.
Mm-hmm.
That there was probably something going on between Velma and Daphne.
Yes. Oh, my God. I hope. Now I'm going to go back and watch with that lens.
There's that scene in Zombie Island where Velma gets levitated. And Daphne's like, now things are getting real interesting.
Yes, I do.
Oh, my.
She's holding down the skirt. Yeah.
Although I remember that one. Velma also ended up, though, with a hunky gardener who was actually like an FBI agent.
He was, yes.
Bo
the gardener.
Oh, yes, Bo. It's just like, wow, what a Louisiana stereotype here.
Okay. I love how in that movie, at the end of the credits, they have to show Scooby being nice to cats because Scooby's supposed to be nice to animals. And he spends most of the movie chasing cats and being mean.
That's true. I didn't even notice that. Yeah. But, right. All right. Well, I guess with that said, anything else you want to say, Nicole? Or
no, just, you can always email us with any questions or concerns you have about this episode or any other episode. Remakes, Reboots, Revivals @gmail.com. Our handle on Instagram is @RemakesRebootsRevivals, and you can find us on Facebook. I mean, if you type in Remakes, Reboots, Revivals to Google, I don't think much other than this podcast will come up. So it's fairly easy to find us.
Thank God for our good SEO.
AAA. And definitely on that note, stay unoriginal.